Give me a conception of it. Once you conceive it, it's no longer preconceived. See, it's the same idea. They try and abstract words and or intentions and ideas from words or expressions. It can't be done. Once you do that, then you can believe in the ideas are inspired but not the words. But how do you know? All you know is the words. You don't know idea apart from the words. You know the ideas of Paul through his words. You can't get in Paul's mind. You can get into his words in the context and find what they mean. So don't let them assume the unjustified assumption that bracketing reality is the way to understand it. This is not a presuppositional position, but a radical presupposition of its own. It begins with the idea about reality that we should not begin with an idea about reality. It is a form of transcendental idealism. B, the assumption that there is no meaning in the world not given by man. How do we know this? How do we know that something doesn't have meaning before I give it meaning? Furthermore, it's kind of arrogant, this poor bare fact out there, and I got to give it meaning. Maybe there is another mind that gives meaning to everything. Maybe everything finds meaning in the infinite mind, and the world is a meaningful expression of his mind, and I am really thinking God's thoughts after him. After all, that's what we believe as theists. Who's to say that there's no meaning? The meaning that thing has, the ultimate meaning, is the meaning that God has for it. And my job as a finite creature, through his revelation, is to discover his meaning for that fact. And if I give some meaning to it that God didn't give to it, then I'm wrong and he's right. The assumption that there is no meaning until I give it meaning. This is a gross anthropomorphism, making reality in our own image. Well, that's my best shot in a short... shot at Husserl. Any questions about what he's trying to do and why I think it's wrong?
Are they saying that ultimately reality is just a phenomenon of the mind and not nothing more?
Not quite, but let me reword that and tell you what he's saying, and then go back to the Gulf. Here's the noumena, here's the phenomena. They're saying that the phenomena is a manifestation of the noumena. So you can, there's a sense in which you can know reality. You can know the real to you. But the real to you equal your consciousness. The phenomena of your consciousness. You still can't know the real in itself. So it's Kantian. Its whole starting point is Kantian. So you know the phenomena to you. And the phenomena to you is this consciousness before you think about it, before you conceptualize it and state it. Now, with that, having said that, reword your question.
My question was if reality is only phenomenal.
No, there's still a reality in itself, but you can't know it. But for all practical purposes, reality is only phenomena because that's all you can know.
Reality, they're saying exactly what Kant said. They're just emphasizing that phenomena is an aspect of your consciousness.
That's right. There are two things in your consciousness. The object of your consciousness, and you can analyze activity and structures there, or the subject of your consciousness, the transcendental ego. And then he wants to get back to that subject because it's that subject that is giving meaning to that object. Out there's only pure facticity in the world. He's not denying a world out there. But he's saying, take a tree. Tree doesn't have any meaning. Take a stick. It doesn't have any meaning. You give it meaning. Let's take a stick instead of a tree. Here's a stick. What does it mean to you? It might mean a paddle to a parent. It might be something to write in the sand with, or a child. It might mean something to make an arrow out of, to a preliterate. What does it mean? It means what you mean by it. It means the meaning you want to give to it. It doesn't have any meaning in itself. And that's true of everything. That's not true of just sticks or trees or houses or people. Everything in the world of your experience has no meaning in it. You intend it. Therefore, when this gets applied to exegesis, as I said, you've got to get back to the intention in the consciousness of Paul behind this expression. You can end up demythologizing this or whatever you want and getting between it, beyond it in any way you want to try and find out the primitive consciousness of Paul, their existential experience, what it was that's behind it. And Bultmann does this and demythologizes the whole New Testament and gets back to you need an ultimate commitment to the ultimate. It's a good question, and I think the answer to it is no. It is a moot point. You can interpret the other way. But when you look at what he's doing, suppose you believe that there was really a God, and this is really inspired, verbally inspired, and all of that, but you don't believe that there is any analogy or univocal element between God's mind and the Bible, and this is the way he wants you to think about him, but that's not the way he really is, but it's still inspired. And there are some evangelicals who hold that, influenced by Kant. And if that were true, would you say, to rephrase your question, that that God is revealed in Scripture, or would you not? Kind of yes and no answer, see? He's revealed the way he wants you to think about him, but he's not revealed the way he really is in himself. Same answer.
I want to place you back on your soapbox. I'm afraid of adopting this into my hermeneutic.
Oh yeah, there are many, many examples of this, and most of them have been fired from the evangelical institutions at which they have taught too. Let's see if I can get at some real good examples. There was a guy named Marasco, who taught at Biola University, who was using this kind of thing to do redaction on Matthew 10, behind a lot of the redaction criticism. There was a guy named Michaels at Gordon Conwell, who was doing this with the Gospels, New Testament, saying Jesus was, these aren't what Jesus really said, it's what the apostles said. There was another example of this, of concrete, a Jewett at Fuller Seminary was doing the same thing. He didn't get fired, but should have been fired. He did the same thing with Paul and the question of women in 1 Corinthians chapter 11. It's just almost universal among biblical scholars. All you do is you say, look, I know that the text may seem to say this, but we really have to get at the intention behind what it says, and what it says isn't really what it means. The intention behind it is this, and they usually use some external factor, like something from the culture, to do it. An example would be Jack Rogers does this. Jack Rogers of Fuller Seminary in Genesis 1. What's the purpose of Genesis 1? Well, the purpose is to teach us to worship God, not creation. He created it, so you don't worship it. It's creation. Well, that's a good guess. I mean, I wouldn't mind that. That's a good enough guess for the purpose. Now, you take that purpose, that intention, you say, then the real meaning is in that purpose, and all these other statements in Genesis, don't interpret them as a scientific description of the way things really happened, that God really created the world, and that he really created different kinds of things, and really created Adam and Eve from the dust. The intention is so you don't worship the world, you worship God, and the meaning is limited to that intention, and so don't take all these statements as literal descriptions of what occurred. Another example of it is the homosexual reinterpretation of Genesis 18 and 19. If you've ever read, they have some real powerful arguments once you grant this premise, because they say the Canaanite custom, it's been proven by a study of the Canaanite customs, that there was a hospitality custom there, and anybody came under your roof, you were responsible for their life, and their lives were threatened. So the intention here is not to convey that homosexuality is wrong. The intention is to teach that we ought to be hospitable, and therefore don't condemn homosexuality, or at least don't use Genesis 18 and 19 to prove that homosexuality is wrong, because the intention behind that was not that at all. It was to fulfill this hospitality custom. They do the same thing in Leviticus passages in homosexuality. They say that was connected with the temple cult prostitute, and the intention behind that was against idolatry. It had nothing to do with homosexuality. The fact that they were homosexuals was incidental to it. And on and on. I'll give you one more illustration. The Hebrews 2 talks about, quotes Psalm 8, made a little lower than the angels. And you go back to Psalm 8 and it says, made a little lower than God, Elohim. And one author said, in trying to reconcile this, well, if you look at the intention of Hebrews 2, the intention is to talk about the humility of Christ. Sure, he misquoted a verse from the Old Testament. And sure, that it shouldn't have been translated angel, it should have been translated God. But don't worry about that mistake. The intention of the author was to talk about the humility of Christ, so that mistake doesn't count as a mistake. Well, my response to that is, the author quoted the whole verse, and the whole verse says little lower than the angels, and if that's not what it meant, then the author of Hebrews made an error. And by the way, it's very easy to explain that. If you go back to the context in Hebrew, in Psalm 8, Elohim can mean God, it can mean judges, it can mean man. Yahweh always means God, but Elohim doesn't. So grammatically, it could mean a little lower than angels in that context. Furthermore, if the grammatical cue, God is always referred to in the second person. You, thou. And it refers to the angels, it puts it in the third person, so there's a shift there. So I think there are enough grammatical clues in the passage itself that it would make it perfectly good sense to translate it little lower than the angels, which is what the Septuagint did, and the New Testament writer quoting the Septuagint quoted, I think, accurately what the meaning of that passage was and didn't make a mistake. So there are other ways to explain it other than appealing to this intention and saying there was a mistake there. So you get everything from relatively innocent illustrations, that one, to radical ones and denying the literal truth of Genesis and ad infinitum. You can go on and on. Another professor once told me, you can't use John 4 to teach people how to witness. Paul Little in his book uses the pattern of Jesus talking with the woman at the well to get principles of how to witness other people, because that was not the purpose of John 4. The purpose of John 4 was something totally different, so you can't use John 4 to teach people how to witness. When you limit the meaning of the text to the one purpose, then you have eliminated a whole lot of scripture. In fact, Dr. Johnson, Elliot Johnson, used to hold this view, and the thing that provoked him to change his view is a student came to him once and he said, Dr. Johnson, I've been applying literally your hermeneutic here of looking for the purpose of the author and limiting meaning to purpose. And you know what? As I read from my devotions, I'm never sure what the purpose is, and it's robbing the Bible of all the devotional value for me. What do I do? And to his credit, he rethought the whole thing, said, there's something wrong here. Because if meaning is determined on purpose, and as Dr. Honer says, most of the time we're guessing what the purpose is, then most of the time we'd be guessing at meaning. So it's a very dangerous thing from devotion to heresy.
Are you advocating then abandoning a search for a purpose, or merely placing it under importance?
I'm advocating abandoning a search for purpose as determinative of meaning. I am not saying that looking for purpose has no illuminating value on the understanding of the text. But purpose is of absolutely no use in determining meaning of the text. The meaning of the text is in its affirmation, in its context, and the purpose is irrelevant to that. It may be illuminating to that, may be helpful indirectly to that, but it has nothing to do with determining that meaning. Meaning is determined by what the author expressed in this context, in this in these propositions.
How do you, find a middle ground, on that? Just using Hill's and what you just said, back to this called taking you back to the history of words and things like that.
Well, you used the right word, context.
Okay.
Study Dr. Johnson's book on hermeneutics. Look for the contextual clues, both cultural, linguistic, theological, whatever. All
the parameters of the biblical context.
All meaning is determined by context. A text out of its context is a pretext, and all meaning out of its context is a pretext.
By kind of knowing walking up with his wife, Lina, and it's probably the first initial prophecy that they came with.
Is it the first time in the history of philosophy? To my knowledge, it's the first time it was developed. I don't know if it's the first time it was thought. And the second part of your question is that's exactly what I believe, and by the way, I've written an article on it, that why does not, that means does not determine what, but rather just the reverse. What determines why. If you know what it really means, you can know the purposes to which it can be used. And let me give my chair illustration. What's the purpose of a chair? Well, normally the purpose of a chair is to sit in. What's the meaning of a chair? Well, that's different, because you could put a chair to many usages. You could use it for many purposes. You could sit in it, you could stand on it to screw a light bulb, you could put it in a door to open it up to let some breeze in. There are many legitimate purposes for a chair. Even though the author intended it to have someone sit on it, it still has many legitimate purposes. Now, there are illegitimate purposes. There are things you can't do with a chair and still retain its chairness. You can't use it for kindling wood in the fire. You can't break it up and make baseball bats out of it. It's no longer a chair. So you can't do anything with a text. You can't manhandle a text. You got to leave its structure. As long as its structure, the structure of its meaning is retained, it can have many applications. All I'm saying is probably the oldest hermeneutical summary in the world. One meaning, many applications. One interpretation. It may be helpful, it may be indirect, it may be interesting. How was Paul applying this? First thing is, well, my son graduated in Dallas 2 years ago. I have two sons-in-law who did too, but he was in hermeneutics, longer a chair. So you can't do anything with a text. You can't manhandle a text. You got to leave its structure. As long as its structure, the structure of its meaning is retained, it can have many applications. All I'm saying is probably the oldest hermeneutical summary in the world. One meaning, many applications. One interpretation, many applications. But you don't use an application, a why, to determine the interpretation. It may be helpful, it may be indirect, it may be interesting. How was Paul applying this? First thing is, my son graduated in Dallas 2 years ago. I have two sons-in-law who did too, but he was in hermeneutics class here, a professor who is no longer here, and he had to do his paper on 1 Corinthians 11. He was given the section on the people who are drunk at the Lord's table. And he was asked to find the purpose of that passage, and he determined that the purpose of that passage was they were showing discrimination. And the professor agreed with that, and then my son attempted to apply the passage to practical things in the dormitory and in life at DTS to make it practical. You're preaching a sermon, you use the audience, and he applied it to discrimination in class or discrimination in the dormitory, whatever it was, and the professor said, that's absolutely illegitimate. You can't apply it that way. And my response to that was, well, how do you preach 1 Corinthians 5 then? Because the intention of Paul was to condemn a man who was living with his stepmother in an adulterous relationship. Now, if you limit the meaning to the purpose, then the only time you could preach that passage is if there's a guy in your church who is living with his stepmother. If there's somebody else in adultery, it doesn't apply to that, because that wasn't the intention of the author. See, once you limit application to author's purpose, then the Bible becomes inapplicable for all practical purposes, and that's what happened to the young man who changed Dr. Johnson's view, because he said, I'm reading the Bible, and I don't know what the purpose was, so I don't apply it to my life anymore. The Bible's a useless book, devotion.
Is there a difference between looking for the purpose and studying the argument of the
book? Yes. Same for the argument is good. That is.
So
what I'm asking you to do in these summaries is not look for the purpose of the author. I want the argument, the summary. That's the what, and that's good. Now, what purpose did he want to give that argument? You know, it's like Dr. Ross thinks, and maybe correctly, maybe not, he knows more about Genesis than I do, but he thinks the purpose of Genesis is polemical, you know, against the pagan gods. Maybe so. But don't use that purpose to determine what every little passage means along the way, because you can get some misinterpretations very easily by reading behind the lines and trying to read the author what he thought rather than what he really said. And that's where the danger comes, taking purpose rather than reading the lines, reading between the lines to get back at the intention of the author, and then you get the wrong intention and the wrong interpretation, therefore. The way I would look at it is this. There are the formal cause of meaning is in the text. That's the formal cause. There are material causes. The material cause and other kinds of cause can be outside the text. You can find things like, and culture to me comes outside the text. It's part of the culture in which they live, but you never use extra biblical data like cultural to be determinative of the meaning. The structure must always come from inside the text. The stuff can come from out here. You can get archaeological stuff and cultural stuff and all sorts of things to help you understand it, but make sure that the structure of your argument, the meaning, is right in the text itself. Well, it's a tough one to apply, and the reason that I prefer not to use that illustration is because you never use a controversial illustration where people have emotive predispositions to make a point. So I would prefer not to do that. I prefer to use another one, like greet the brethren with a holy kiss. I think that's an ex. The kiss there falls in this category. I think what falls over here is the greet. You must show friendliness to other believers, but how it is done in terms of the cultural milieu in which they live. That's like Nanook of the Frozen North chews his wife's boots every morning. Greater love hath no Eskimo wife than this. The boots get hard overnight, and they chew them to make them soft and warm. So the wife chews her husband's boots. It's an act of love. But now, if the Bible were written in that culture, it would have said, chew your husband's boots every morning. Because the form is in the text. The form is the structure, the chairness in the text. You get the essence, you find the principle, you find the proposition that is being affirmed, and then you look at the cultural milieu which is expressing it. This is the what, that is the how. What, greet, how, kiss. Or as Philip said, pass the handshake all around. Some cultures it's two kisses, one kiss, some on the nose, some on the cheek, some two hugs, some three hugs, some handshake. That's the relative, that's the how. What is not relative is the absolute, the what. It's not an either or. It's a both and. You use Romans 14, 1 Corinthians 8, the meat offered to idols to solve all those dark issues, those middle cases, you know. The meat was offered to an idol. It was put in a cut-rate meat market. It was being bought by Christians. They want to be economical as anybody else. And it was perfectly all right to eat it, provided that it didn't offend somebody else who was an idolater and lead him into sin. So I think all of those borderline cultural cases have to be determined by those principles. Well, we're going to have more of this, so don't. So hang on. We got Heidegger and the rest, so you can get the rest of your questions in along the line. But let's start Heidegger here. The Life of Heidegger, 1889. Yeah. Right. The real chair is on this, is the same thing. Gaul and the noumenal. And add one other dimension as long as you're using the chair in the gulf. The real chair has no meaning in and of itself. It is pure facticity. It's pure thatness. Just like the noumena. You know that the noumena is, but you don't know what the noumena is. So that not only is the real chair on the right side of the gulf, but all the reality it has is pure thatness. Whatever whatness the chair has, you gave to it on the other side of the gulf. Because you gave the meaning to that chair. You gave its purpose. You gave its intention. As far as you're concerned, that chair is to sit on. And you might be so narrow-minded with the use of a chair that you won't let your kids stand on it or screw a light bulb with it, you know. But that's the purpose of that chair for you, and that's the meaning of it. We must move on. Martin Heidegger, Life of Heidegger, born in Baden to a Catholic family, trained in phonological method of Husserl at the University of Freiburg, wrote a dissertation on the categories and theory of meaning in Duns Scotus, Tübingen, 1916, was provost University of Freiburg. Under the reign of Hitler, he publicly renounced Husserl and removed the dedication from his book, Being and Time, he had dedicated to Husserl, who is a Jew. He's teaching in Hitler Germany when that was not real popular for and prosperous for your future to be dedicating your book to a Jew. So he publicly renounced to remove the dedication, though he left a footnote, which apparently the Nazis didn't read. He left a footnote acknowledging his debt to Husserl. He was influenced by Brentano's dissertation on Being in Aristotle, and appears unaware of the influence of Plotinus on his thought. I couldn't find any references to Plotinus, and yet his whole view is Plotinian. His basic metaphysical question was asked by Schelling and Leibniz. Why is there something rather than nothing? He asked the right question, and he gave the wrong answer. The works of Heidegger, Sein und Zeit, translated Being and Time, Kant and the Problem of Metaphysics, What is Metaphysics, translated Existence and Being, On the Essence of Truth, and Introduction to Metaphysics, Questions of Being, and What is Philosophy? Influence on Heidegger. Husserl's phenomenological method, Nietzsche's nihilistic concerns, Hegel's historical approach, Kierkegaard's personal subjectivity, and Plotinus's mystical metaphysics. Mix, add a little salt and pepper, bake at 350 degrees, and guess what you get? A lot of interesting things, as we'll see, including Bultmann and the rest. It's interesting to compare Kierkegaard, Nietzsche, and Heidegger. One's a theist, one's an anti-theist, and one's a non-theist, more of a pantheist. Kierkegaard said God is dead in the church, Nietzsche said God is dead in the culture, and Heidegger said God is dead in metaphysics. Kierkegaard said God is dead ecclesiastically, culturally for Nietzsche, and metaphysically for Heidegger. Kierkegaard said authenticity is found in eternity. Nietzsche said authenticity is found in futility. Will the eternal recurrence of the same state of affairs? And Heidegger says it's found in temporality.